The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
If you want to encourage office attendance, think about the experience that somebody has when they come into the office. And actually, you'll see younger people very willing to come into the office if it's linked to a lunch or a night out afterwards or free breakfast. So I think it's important to recognise what motivates people to want to be in or want to work from home, and to look at it from the perspective of how can you encourage people to come back in. So make it the carrot rather than the stick.
Welcome, listeners. I'm really excited to welcome you to another episode of the Hearing podcast. Today, my guest is Kate Dodd. Kate is an employment and equality law partner at Pinson Masons, and she's also the leading voice on how workplace culture, equality law, and organisational strategy intersect. Kate advises major employers on navigating complex issues around hybrid working, inclusion, and the employee experience. She's been at the forefront of discussions on how the UK organisations are approaching return to office expectations in 2025 and beyond. And this is what we talked a lot about in this episode. We explored the legal, cultural, and generational dynamics shaping the modern workplace, from the Equality Act, which is the UK legislation, the implications of that act, of hybrid policies, to the role of leadership and shifting employee expectations. And also, Kate predicted what the next 5 years might hold for workplace flexibility. It's a really timely and insightful discussion, and I'm delighted to have Kate discuss it with us. Hope you enjoy the episode.
The Hearing.
Welcome to the podcast, Kate. Great to have your company. Nice to see you. Nice, easy first question for you. Could you tell us a bit about your background? Because you're a partner at Pinson Masons, and also I believe you are head of Brooke Graham. So I'd love to hear more about Brooke Graham and what you do there.
Yeah, fabulous. Thank you. Thank you for having me. So I am a partner at Pinson Masons. I've been an employment lawyer since 2002. Many moons ago now. I have long been a discrimination specialist, and from 2016 through to 2020, I did a specialist EDI role, so quality, diversity, inclusion, and essentially that involved me. At the time, we were a client of Brooke Graham, which is an EDI consultancy. We actually ended up buying them. It was a Remington situation whereby we worked with them at Pinson Masons. We liked them so much that we bought them when they went up for sale. And since 2017, Brooke Graham has been part of Pinson Masons. I returned to employment lawyering in 2021 and took over Brooke Graham at that stage. So my current practice is a real mixture of really predominantly equality law work, employment work, of course, and also EDI, and running Brooke Graham.
Brilliant. And I came across you years ago when I went to Pinson Masons, did a talk there. And recently it was brought to my attention, you did a fantastic video on practical law, talking about something extremely topical about return to work policy. So I'd love to unpack that with you, you know, from a legal standpoint, what are the key issues culturally as well? And sometimes there's a generational divide, isn't there, between leadership and younger people working within law firms. So
yeah,
first point, really, from a legal standpoint, what do you think are the key issues employers need to consider when they're introducing or enforcing return to work policies?
Yeah, so from a legal perspective, really it starts off with the contract, as many of these things do. So what does a contract say, basically? Regardless of what the contract strictly says, of course, you can have varied that through custom and practice. So what we would normally start by looking at, it, let's say you had an employer who wanted people to be in the office more regularly, you'd be saying to them, what does the contract say? If you've got people who have got home working contracts, obviously it would be a breach of their contract to suddenly force them to be in the office. But ordinarily, you would have employers, many of whom haven't updated their contracts since COVID, who actually already there have a requirement to be in the office perhaps 5 days a week. However, it's not quite as simple, therefore, as simply saying, right, it's in your contract, therefore we can insist on everybody coming back. Because as I said, there is often a situation where the strict terms of the contract will have been varied by custom and practice. Also, lots of employers will have introduced hybrid working policies. So then there will be the interplay of that hybrid working policy, formal and informal flexible working requests, etc., to be layered on top. So it can be quite complicated. At your highest, you could risk a claim for probably constructive dismissal. So forcing somebody to come back to work, which is in... so detrimental to them that it's as if you've dismissed them. And that's the kind of the test for constructive dismissal. You also risk discrimination complaints, particularly around disability and sex discrimination, which I can come on to later. And I think what we're really seeing is a steady increase at the moment in employment tribunal litigation, with tribunal claims that are citing office attendance as either a key or one of the kind of side issues. And interestingly, of course, what we're increasingly seeing is industrial action. So either strikes or actions short of strikes being taken on the basis of office mandated working practices. And what we know is that unions are seeing increasing participation by their members when they're balloting for things like industrial action. And there have been lots of examples recently where, particularly in the public sector, where entire workforces or parts of workforces have either gone out on strike or they've started to work to rule in protest against employers mandating more frequent office attendance.
Yeah, and obviously conscious that we have a US listeners as well. This is all UK-based. So as we're talking about the UK, I want to get into the Equality Act 2010, which is UK legislation. How might hybrid working policies intersect with the 2010 Act?
Yeah, so at the moment, there's two key ways in which it could potentially interact with the Equality Act. There are others on the horizon, potentially, which I will touch on at the end. But the key issues are going to be disability and indirect sex discrimination. So taking disability first, somebody under the Equality Act in the UK is protected against disability discrimination if they have a mental or a physical impairment that has a substantial adverse impact on their ability to carry out day-to-day activities, basically. So it can be a mental health issue. It could be neurodiversity, for example. It could be a physical health issue. All of those things could be covered. And something that employers are required to do where they have employees with a disability is to make reasonable adjustments. And something that is very much considered to be a reasonable adjustment for certain individuals is an allowance for that person to work from home, perhaps more often, more regularly than others, or potentially always to work from home. And where employers get themselves into difficulty around office attendance is the fact that often they will want to apply a blanket policy whereby they say, look, everybody needs to be back in the office more often. We're not seeing enough people in. We're not having enough, you know, teams working together, for example. So we want everybody back in. And they think that because they're applying that to everybody and they're not picking out individuals, that they're going to be okay, basically. But that's not how it works, of course, with discrimination, because what discrimination will do is it will say, okay, you might have a blanket rule, but does that have a more of an adverse impact on certain groups of people? And you can easily see there how somebody with a disability could be more disadvantaged. Through COVID, it was really interesting because actually it was often people who had reduced immune systems. It was people who perhaps were suffering from anxiety, panic disorders, depression, for example, who might have found it more difficult, people with OCD. We saw a lot of type claims of those nature, people who were either worried about being in the office or indeed commuting. What we see probably more now is people who, for example, have got a neurodiverse condition, which is much easier for them to manage when they're at home. It might be that they struggle with kind of interaction, and it might be that for those individuals, it would be a reasonable adjustment to allow them to work from home either all the time or more regularly. But the tribunal will consider whether or not that's exactly what is going on. So we've seen some cases recently where people were citing disability as a reason for working from home, but actually the tribunal found that they were actually trying to avoid performance management, for example. And the tribunals will be pretty pretty firm, you know, not particularly sympathetic if they think that somebody is essentially trying to work from home for reasons that actually are unrelated to any disability.
Yeah, exactly. And it's only the tribunal who can decide whether someone meets that definition, which you just gave us.
That's
about
right.
Whether they are considered disabled for the purposes under the Act. I think a lot of organisations probably don't realise how wide that definition is, not just sticks and wheelchairs, but certainly, as you said, will include neurodivergence as well, ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, autism. And it's the travelling in which may be the issue for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Which could cause fatigue or anxiety or, you know, extra time getting up even earlier in the morning to make that journey. Even though, you know, access to work, which I'm sure you've come across, the government scheme, which is designed to actually try and remove the barriers for disabled people to stay in work and get to work. I mean, they paid for my, when I had my injury, they paid for my taxi trips to and from work. This was well before COVID as well.
Yeah.
But I know they've been, access to work has made the press quite recently because they're huge cuts for some people. And so a lot of very high profile disabled people have not been able to carry on with their work because access to work has made cuts. But that provision is still there for people. But still, it may be appropriate for home working. But as you said, it's only a tribunal who can to make that decision.
And that's a really important point, I think, Yasmin, because we would always encourage our clients to go to occupational health, to take occupational health advice, to go to a specialist, for example. Employers should never be deciding themselves whether or not somebody's likely to meet the definition of a disability, nor should they say, well, so-and-so had the same condition as you and they weren't found to be disabled and therefore you aren't either, type of thing. You know, this idea of armchair medics and therefore, you know, taking that expert advice is really important. As you say, access to work used to be fantastic. Employers would be very heavily criticised if not find themselves at the wrong end of a tribunal decision if they ignored the kinds of grants or the kinds of assistance available from access to work. Similarly, actually, I always encourage my clients to talk to, if there are so many fantastic charities and a lot of them will have grants available. So if you're facing into a situation where you've got a disabled employee who is struggling to get to work or needs adaptations for financial reasons, a tribunal would always look at an employer's size and administrative resources to decide what's reasonable. So for a corner shop, it would be a lot less than, let's say, for Pins and Masons. But you are then also expected to look and see what other sources of support are out there, basically, before making a final decision.
Absolutely. Internal resources and external resources available.
Yeah.
Something you said, Kate, reminded me of the legally disabled research. I don't know if you've come across that piece of research. Yeah, I think I've mentioned it in previous episodes of this podcast, where it was really groundbreaking research looking at the career experiences of disabled legal professionals, either with a visible or a non-visible disability. And the research found pre-COVID, the most requested and refused reasonable adjustment was in fact home working and flexible working.
Yeah.
And it's interesting now there is more of a push to try and get back to normal, whatever normal was, you know, prior to the pandemic, getting people into the office. But as you say, you know, in the work that we do, equality, diversity and inclusion, a blanket policy doesn't mean we're treating people equally. In fact, we sometimes need to treat people differently in order to achieve that equity and remove barriers for people. I feel like I'm doing a training session now.
No, I completely, absolutely, completely agree with you.
But I think that the legally disabled research was relevant in that context of what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
Sorry, did you want to say something else?
No, I mean, I was going to talk about the other key aspect of the office working, which is indirect sex discrimination. So the, you know, what we often talk about when we're thinking about the Equality Act is disability. There is also a huge amount of case law, tribunal case law, where people who have childcare responsibilities are more likely to be women, and therefore that is a statistic. People don't need to show that statistic or prove it now. It's taken as a given. So women are able to bring in direct sex discrimination complaints on the basis that they have childcare responsibilities, and are able to bring arguments to say that they should be allowed to have home working if that assists them with their childcare. Now, there is, and I can't stress this enough, this does not mean people working from home whilst looking after their children. And that has been a big issue for a lot of my clients, particularly since COVID, because I think what happened in COVID is that lots of childcare provisions shut down. So people started to have to, by necessity, look after their children whilst they were working. That was certainly my experience. And then a lot of people have been slow to go back to things like after school clubs, holiday clubs, breakfast clubs, etc. Now, a tribunal will not be sympathetic to somebody who says, I need to work from home because I've also got my baby here, or I've got my children here, because actually somebody is being paid to work. They're not being paid to look after their children from home. But what the tribunal will be sympathetic to is there flexibility around this person's working pattern that should or could be implemented to make it easier for them to do drop off, pick up, etc. And you do see that you know, the tribunal will be interested, and you know, they will be critical of an employer who has a simple blanket ban, for example. So, you know, if a company has a good reason for refusing somebody to work from home, then that is likely to trump, you know, this, because it's indirect discrimination, which can be justified. You can justify indirect discrimination, you can't with direct. Whereas actually, as long as you can show that there is no less favourable way of operating, then you can show that that is something that's necessary. And of course, the one thing we haven't touched upon yet is the fact that this home working creates a real two-tier workforce in lots of our clients, because there will be people whose roles are not able to be done from home. And therefore, it's very important also to think about that. And there will be employers who are very keen not to have a two-tier workforce, and therefore they will operate a more, you know, mandate more office attendance to try and create more equality between those whose roles can be done from home and those who can't, basically.
And you say about women, you know, mostly childcare will fall on them, and therefore it could constitute a form of direct discrimination if they have a blanket policy. But also, I'm thinking about you know, the so-called sandwich generation, where a lot of women are looking after elderly parents and young children. Does the law say anything about carers and their responsibilities?
So that's a really interesting one. It would be potentially, again, indirect discrimination. I think you would, I don't know, and I could be wrong here, but I think there is definitely research to show that women are more likely to be carers than men. But I'm not, it's not, I don't think you, there is a green, you know, it's almost with childcare, you no longer have to show. In the olden days, each time you wanted to bring or defend a claim for indirect discrimination for women, you know, in, who wanted to, let's say, work part time, which is what it used to be more, and obviously more so recently, more working from home. I don't think there's a kind of a green, just a passport through in the way that there is for childcare, but I could see that, yes, that is definitely going to be an increasing burden on individuals, particularly because of the crisis in social care that we are also facing into in the country, where older people, there is simply not the resources for them to have the kind of care that they need in their homes. And this, of course, this burden therefore falls on often working people. And as you say, Yasmin, often working people who are also juggling childcare responsibilities.
Because I'm hearing more and more and seeing more and more friends who are sort of my sort of age dealing with this juggling act, you know, parents or older, younger children, and mostly women, anecdotally, I can say, are dealing with that, saying, you know, actually, if it wasn't for a flexible working policy, working from home, I really don't know how I would be able to do it. So that's why I threw in that question.
Yeah, and there is, I won't go into it now because it's quite complicated, but there is also a grounds of claim, basically the same disadvantage. So men can actually bring a claim for indirect discrimination if they can show they've got the same disadvantage as women who are you know, also caring for children or for you know, the different people who are experiencing disadvantages in the workplaces. There is now a potential claim for the same disadvantage. So it is extending the scope of protections available to employees.
Yes. And in respect of generational attitudes, how are they influencing organisations towards, you know, work and flexibility?
Yeah, it's really interesting, the whole piece around generational difference. I mean, the fact that we call it return to office, it shows that, you know, that we're talking, I'm talking about it as a, you know, woman in my late 40s, where for me, it is a return to office working. Of course, for anyone who's joined the workforce, and it's, you know, obviously hundreds of thousands of people who've joined the workforce since 2020, they've never been in the office 5 days a week. So we have to be really careful even in the language we use. And I would encourage clients to not talk about return to office, but just to talk about it as, you know, office working mandates, essentially. Because, of course, there are huge numbers of people for whom it's not a return. The whole cultural, the generation piece is interesting. There is definitely a feeling, I think, under when we talk to our clients, which I do a lot about generational diversity, a feeling that younger people don't want to be in the office as often, that they don't want to work as hard. They don't, and particularly actually for lots of my clients, they don't want to travel as much. So, you know, we have a lot of construction engineering clients who are really struggling to find people who are willing to go and work on site, you know, go and live in what you call, it's probably a very UK word, but known as a bunker bin. So it's almost like a kind of a container on a building site that's been turned into a living accommodation. And they're saying that they are really struggling to find younger people who are willing to do that kind of working, even though it has been done for generations and is something that's just simply been required before. That said, there is also actually lots of research to show that younger people are really interested in the experience of work. And therefore, if you, and I think this is probably going to be a big theme of my advice to clients, because this is what I say to my own clients all the time. If you want to encourage office attendance, think about the experience that somebody has when they come into the office. And actually, you'll see younger people very willing to come into the office if it's linked to, I don't know, a lunch or a night out afterwards, or, you know, free breakfast, or, you know what I mean? There's all sorts of ways of motivating people who want to enjoy the experience of being in the office. But yeah, I do think there is still this mix of generations. That said, I think that older generations have also really appreciated the flexibility. So I think it's important to recognize what motivates people to want to be in or want to work from home, and to look at it from the perspective of, you know, how can you encourage people to come back in? So make it the carrot rather than the stick, basically.
Yeah. And there's no point, you know, some people say, well, I go into the office, there's no one actually there, so I don't understand the point of that. And I'm seeing a shift where actually, if you are requiring people to come into the office, they usually will combine it with an event or a training day or a team building day or something which, as you say, motivates people. And there's a real purpose for coming in, not just doing your work, but if people do want that camaraderie, that connection with teams, you've the employer really has to think very hard, well, how can we make that happen for that person?
Yeah.
The hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day, in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
As allegiances are tested.
You're gambling with World War III.
And regimes fall.
Fighters and civilians continue to stream in from other parts of Syria.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News podcast is there. We make sense of the news shaping our world and give you everything you need to know in a 10-minute podcast every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
So what role do you think leadership plays in terms of shaping the tone of these policies? I mean, do you see leaders modelling that flexibility themselves? Or
yeah, and I think that is absolutely essential, is that you've got leaders who are willing to walk the talk, because you cannot have leaders who say, everybody come in, but I'm going to be at home, basically. I think it makes a big difference in terms of how long people's commutes are. So interestingly, of course, is in the UK, obviously, we have London waiting. Most of our clients will apply London waiting to salaries, which means that people who work from London or London offices are paid more because they are, generally speaking, going to have higher transport and accommodation, etc. costs. Now, they are also probably less likely to want to come in every day because they might have a longer commute, as opposed to people who are, you know, working in cities outside of London. So what we're saying in relation to leadership is essentially to walk the talk, but also to be really consistent, to show the benefits of being in. And, you know, as you say, can you link it to something? You probably can't do that every day. But if you are in, you know, if you are the leader and you are asking your people to be in, then you being in as well, but also spending time with people, taking time to go and sit and have lunch with everybody, taking time to say to somebody, well, you know, I've actually got a client call in a few minutes. Would you like to come with me? Or I've got this, you know, I've got a meeting. Would you like to attend? So that it becomes not just somebody who is role modeling being in the office, but also role modeling the benefits and the behaviours that they want to see when people are in together. You know, that kind of experience of not just kind of being around other people, but also learning, supervision, etc.
And I certainly think back to my trainees days very, very long ago. And I learned through osmosis,
yeah.
You know, I learned through just observing, how does my supervising partner talk to a client on the phone? Or, you know, if you tended to sit in with your supervising partner. And that was the whole point. You're obviously doing the work that they've given, allocated to you, but you're actually observing and watching everybody around the office. And obviously, those people who are coming into the profession, if they're not used to that, when they do come in, it would be good if actually they could observe, attend meetings, you know, really be part of office life as well.
Yeah, absolutely right. Because you can only learn when you see it happening. You know, there is no kind of pre-programmed microchip that you can put into your head and suddenly know, you know, how to deal with, particularly with conflict or with difficult situations. I think it's all, you know, you can be used to having quite kind of calm and you know, reasonable conversations. And then somebody, you pick up the phone to the other side, let's say, or you pick up the phone to a claimant if you're acting on behalf of a company and have a very difficult conversation. That can be very hard to process if you're at home on your own. Whereas when you're in the office, you can kind of turn around and say, well, that was awful. And immediately you've got kind of support network around you to, you know, let you vent a little bit, but also to give you some feedback to say, oh, have you thought of this or that? One thing I do know, because I remember speaking to some insurers back in, it must have been 2022, within the legal sector, there was a real increase in professional indemnity insurance claims because of the lack of supervision of junior lawyers working from home. So there is a direct correlation in my mind, and obviously it was in the mind of the insurers. I don't know if that's still the case now, but at the time in particular, there was a direct correlation between people working from home and not getting properly supervised. Partly, I suppose, because a lot of the time it will have been, you know, you could hear somebody talking and you might say, well, I don't think that's quite right. But more often than not, I think it's about people worrying about interrupting other people to ask questions. Far more likely, I mean, when I'm in the office, I almost have to kind of, you know, cement myself to the fact that I'm going to probably spend 2 hours of that day answering questions in a way that I wouldn't normally if I was at home, because people will be like, oh, should I ring her? Is she on Teams? Is she green on Teams? Whereas what we do is we try and ensure there's always someone who's senior in the office, that, so therefore there is always someone that our junior lawyers can ask questions of. So, and they know, therefore, if they're going to have a difficult day or if they've got loads of tricky cases, for example, right, well, this is a great day to go in the office because I know that there's going to be someone senior there and I can just bounce things off them. And, you know, maybe I can stack up a load of questions I've had and take, you know, book in half an hour for a walking meeting. Or we've got a terrace now, I'm very pleased, so we go and I've been making my team sit outside on the terrace, we're wrapped in blankets and having our sitting outside for, you know, these kind of discussions, and it's nice to get some fresh air, you know, at the same time as doing it.
Yeah, that's a great idea, actually, having someone senior in at that time so that junior members of staff can come in, because it's very artificial, isn't it, when you're both working from home and then scheduling a call for something that may take 30 seconds if that person overheard you in the office. It's just not as natural. And my main thing when I think back to my trainee days, I always would think, am I interrupting? Am I causing a problem? But if you've got the visual clues, you know, you're sitting with someone, you can see where there's that natural break, or as you say, they could have overheard you and then have a conversation afterwards.
Yeah, and so many times, people will, I'll stand up and say, does anyone want a cup of tea? And someone will say, I'll come with you to the kitchen, because then they can ask me something on the way. You know, and I know that I'm certainly not alone in that. It's just an opportunity for people to think, oh yeah, I'll quickly grab her for this few minutes. And you're much more likely to, you know, someone's much more likely to, you know, we have Monday Club, which is essentially, because I like to be in the office on a Monday. So we have Monday Club, which means that I always say to people, you know, let's come in to the office, because it can be a bit like, oh, you know, you've had a nice weekend and suddenly it's like, right, grown, back to the office, back to the grindstone. And actually being in and amongst each other can be really good for your mental health, and also really good just for that kind of, right, get your head back into the game type of thing. So, I mean, we don't really do anything, and Monday Club's probably a bit of a false word because it makes it sound more exciting than it really is. But just, you know, and it allows also us to, me and the other managers in the team, is, you know, we have a WhatsApp group to say, right, which days are you going to be in this week? So that we make sure that there's that senior cover across all 5 days as well. Mm. So, and so it works really well.
I was going to say, I want to join this Monday Club because I need... going on the Monday as well.
Monday motivation, exactly. And then, absolutely.
Yeah, you really have to change your management style, don't you, when people are working in this different way. And I think, you know, trainees or junior members of staff may feel more reluctant to perhaps ask questions, but also thinking from the supervising partner or manager's side, you have to consciously check in with people if they are working from home. And that does take an effort. If they're not visibly there in the office, you've got to schedule those Zoom calls, Teams meeting calls to check how people are. It's to help with their well-being and just feeling comfortable asking questions if they're not isolated then.
Agreed. And actually, someone not coming into the office can sometimes be a bit of a flag to say that they're struggling, you know, and you can say, you know, what's happening. And you know, often they'll say, oh, I've got a builder coming or the boiler's being fixed or something, which is of course fine, but it just gives you a little bit of a flag to say, right, do I need to just check in with that person again to see that they really are okay. One thing I think as well is for efficiency, it drives me mad if someone sends me a long email when I'm sitting right next to them and I just say to them, like, I'll turn around to them and say, look, I could have saved you that. This is a 3-second conversation as opposed to no doubt 10 minutes writing an email, waiting for me to open my emails to then see it. Do you know what I mean? So it can really, office working can really drive efficiency, time efficiency in particular. So that's another thing to sit down and to talk about as a team, though, is just to say, like, what are the benefits for us and how do we make the most of them?
Mm. And do you have examples of organisations that have managed this well? I mean, what are Pinsent Masons doing in terms of saying to people being in the office how many days? And obviously you have adjustments for those people who require it.
Yes.
Do you have a policy of such?
So it's interesting. I don't think we have a formal policy. The different groups have their own policy. So within employment, we have 3 days in if you're full time, 3 days in the office, 2 days from home. That seems to work really well for us. Obviously, if somebody has got lots on, or if they're poorly, or, you know, there can be weeks when they don't do their 3 days, but, and it's not policed rigidly, but it just tends to be it is We will always attempt to do 3 days. I only work 4 days, but I go in three because I feel like I need to kind of lead by example. And most of our lawyers say that there is real benefit to being in, and therefore it kind of, it polices itself in that people will see the benefit and therefore they will want to be in. I think we have been really clear about what the benefits are. So it doesn't feel just like we're saying to people, you need to be in. We talk about why we, make it make worthwhile. I mean, I'm often not invited to things, because who wants a partner hanging out with them at lunchtime, basically. But, there is always stuff going on with our team. Our lawyers will get together, and there is real interaction in the office. And I think that is really important. And I think also because we're fairly typical for the market, people don't feel that they're being forced into the office more than other firms, for example. So I think that is one thing to think about when you're, how do you do this well? I would say talk and be really clear about the benefits of being in the office together. Talk to people about what days work best for them so that they don't just suddenly have kind of certain days forced upon them. We have anchor days, but there is no one day that everybody's forced to be in, because it might be that the anchor day for them is the day that, that doesn't work for them. And then I think more than anything is just being really clear from the outset and being consistent. So when we have new joiners into our team, I always say to people at interview, we are in 3 days a week. Would that work for you? Because what we don't want is somebody who is used to working 4 days a week from home, who then kind of joins, and only after they join do they think, oh God, I wish I hadn't come here because, I don't want to be in the office. So I think it's being clear about the benefits and also being really consistent.
Absolutely. And that communication with people is essential, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how do you see workplace flexibility evolving legally and culturally over the next 5 years? What would you say?
Yeah, I think legally that there will continue to be litigation, basically. I think there is a continued rebalancing post-COVID. There are a lot of clients, really probably over the last 2 years, who have started to try and mandate much more office attendance than they used to have. Some are experiencing more pushback than others. So I think there will be this continued rebalancing. I think that the impact of the Employment Rights Bill will also be huge, because what we're likely to see, we're still waiting, but is much more flexible working requests coming in, flexibility being, flexible by default almost is how the government wants to see things. But the House of Lords have got a home-based working committee, and they've already flagged the fact that they see changes to flexible working under the Employment Rights Bill as potentially risking what they describe as years of litigation unless the changes in the upcoming changes are designed really clearly and effectively. Because if there is any kind of ambiguity, or if it's not really clearly set out, then what we're going to have is a lot of litigation trying to flush out what the law is. So very hopeful that that is very clear. I think that employers will continue to need to be very clear and consistent. And what I would say is that if employers don't operate some sort of flexibility, then they're much more likely to see formal flexible working applications. Whereas employers who have a good, robust and consistently applied hybrid policy are much less likely to get lots of actual formal flexible working requests. If you asked me to predict what the average would be, I would say probably 3 days probably will be the most that most employers will mandate. We have seen travel from the US being much more 5-day office attendance, but that is highly unpopular. There have been a lot of surveys recently where people have basically said, if I'm required to be in the office more often than I am already, then I will look for a new job. So people value this element of flexibility. And it is also something that people will maybe take lower pay, or, maybe it's very high up on people's lists of things. So therefore, you need to really be able to demonstrate the basis on which you're asking for your office attendance, and also to make sure that you are not wildly out of whack with your competitors, because otherwise you will lose people if you are less flexible than they are, because we know it is something that people, individual employees, value so highly.
Fantastic, Kate. That's a great way to end. You've ended with messages you'd really like to leave business leaders who are rethinking their workplace strategies right now. So very practical tips. Thank you very much for your time. And I'm sure our listeners will find that incredibly helpful. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/The Hearing. Or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.